Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
This week on Meet and Three, I'm about to go on maternity leave. This is Katie Mosman-Wadler, and before I leave you in the incredibly capable hands of Team HRN, we are rounding out Season 5 with a deep dive into the food rules, weird cravings, and overall hype about eating while pregnant.
There are a lot of safe foods to eat, and we shouldn't be sort of assuming that just because something is raw that it's dangerous.
I just found myself feeling like there was an alien piloting my body and brain, and totally changed the way that I ate.
So was it the eggplant? Sure. Why not? I just don't know.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat and Three anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'll be back soon with our newest and tiniest producer in tow.
Morning, y'all. Today is Thursday, January 16th. I'm Trig Brown, and this is The Main Course. I'm here in the studio without Brandon, Patrick, or Emily. They're at the Good Food Awards in San Francisco. Today, we have a special guest in the studio, Chris Grosso. Chris is a TV and video director and producer. He is former network executive at Viceland and co-founder of Munchies. Chris has interviewed hundreds of the best chefs in the world and has revolutionized the way people understand and access food, especially from an industry perspective. His vocation seems to stem from an extensive knowledge of restaurants and food landscapes, which he documents with a photographic memory. Whether you're walking up Grand Street in Brooklyn or driving through South Philly, if you're with Chris, he can talk about the constellations of food establishments and their idiosyncrasies like an oral culinary historian. Do you like the word oral, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wasn't nervous before, but now with that intro, it's going to be an even bigger letdown to your listeners.
The bar is set extremely high.
We also have our dear friend, Matt, back today as a panelist, former sous chef at Kraft Restaurant, now purveyor of the best meats in New York, aside from Heritage Foods USA Pork. Mac and Chris often embark upon food journeys together, and I've been lucky to go on a couple myself. Welcome, guys. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, we've been to went to Philly once.
Yeah, went to Philly. We also went to
where else? New Haven, Connecticut.
Went to New Haven,
and I would say probably one of the most one of the best times we've had surrounding food was when Mac took all of the amazing product that he gets and brought it to your place on the day off, and we got to cook all that venison and.
We had venison, we had wagyu, we had lamb.
We had some pork skirts from.
We had everything.
Yeah, it was really good. But all of our hangs seem to be around really good food, even on your buddy's rooftop when we do the beef cheek barbecue sandwiches. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Super fun. All right, so in honor of Patrick and Emily, we won't skip their game of word association. Basically, we've just selected a couple words and terms and asked that you respond in 10 words or less. Chris, the word or term I selected for you is Jonathan Benno.
10 words or less. That's a very particular person and maybe the subject of my favorite episode of Chef's Night Out.
All right, cool. We'll come back to that. Mac, we got road rage for you.
Road rage is life if you live in New York City.
I feel you. Sometimes I think that road rage is like, even though it's real, even though it's really unhealthy, it, you know, it's kind of good to get it out there.
Expressed, you know? Road rage is unhealthy.
Yeah.
Getting out of the car, that's unhealthy.
Of course.
Right. In the car, fuck you, get out of the way, yeah. Use your indicator.
Yes.
You piece of shit, move it. Those are things that help you as a driver in a heavily trafficked city.
Yeah, agreed. Road rage is my edge, right?
Yeah.
Like I always say in New York, you have to drive aggressively. It's the passive drivers who ruin the road.
Yeah.
So you just have to make a decision and go with it. And when people ruin that for you, that is when it sets you into a landslide of just frustration and anger.
Well, why are you driving all the time in New York City?
I just set that up. I just like it. Now, to be perfectly honest, I enjoy driving. I'm from Ohio, where you drive. I feel like I control my own.
But you're not in the car for work reasons?
Yes. But I also drive when I don't have to.
Yeah.
So I try to never drive if I go to the city. Like, because yeah, why?
Agreed.
You know what I mean? But sometimes you do. And when you do, it's just, it's time to go. You know, yeah. It's just time to go, baby. Gotta light it up.
Oh, my God.
The swearing is like a haya, right? In karate, it's like it helps you.
Yeah.
Get more energy out.
It's an enunciation.
Yeah, it's a focal point.
Exactly.
Energy. And anybody who drives with their wife sitting shotgun or partner or whatever, they are usually the most unsupportive.
I know. I just wish,
you
know, sometimes.
Like if you see somebody coming and they're always, and it's like, I see it. You just made.
Reaching forward, bracing on the airbag.
Oh, Emily encourages it up to almost unhealthy point.
Oh, that's encourages amazing. What?
She likes when I yell at people, roll down the window. God. She giggles or when I get involved in honking. She
really
thinks that's funny.
Oh, that's amazing.
It's Chris's wild side. It's his wild.
So why did why was Jonathan Benno? Why was that your favorite episode of Munchies?
For those who don't know, Jonathan Benno was a chef. He was the head chef at French Laundry. Then he opened up Per Se, I believe. And then he had a restaurant in Lincoln Center called Lincoln.
Yeah, he also was an opening team member at Kraft.
At Kraft, yeah. Very talented chef. And early on when Lauren Cinnamon and myself kind of took over the Munchies series that was on Vice before it became a full-blown website, I reached out to a bunch of chefs that I had known from, you know, working in restaurants and asked if they wanted to come on this show called, you know, Munchies. I did some, you know, we did kind of like a new version of the show. And then after that, people started reaching out and they wanted to do it.
Right.
He had had lunch with Michael White, chef, Alta Maria Group, chef owner, whatever it is. And, he said, I just had lunch with Michael White. He said that he did this show called Munchies and that I would have a lot of fun doing it. And he emailed me. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, like,
yeah.
Great, cool. This is different. You know, a big thing we would always get were, oh, I work with this chef. He has tattoos. He'd be perfect for your show. And they'd be like, no, that's not why. I was like, what do they do? You know? And like, and so, but I was like, okay, John, this makes it. This is, we're about people's stories. It's not about how someone looks, especially for that series. And we went to his restaurant to go shoot this show, Chef's Night Out. And basically you go to their restaurant, you film them doing three of their most famous dishes and kind of talking through it, film like a little bit of service. And then they have friends meet them and then they go out for the night, which usually consists of 2 to 3 stops. You guys, you know, were
drinking,
having a good time. Not necessarily drinking.
Life.
It's just what you do after work. Yeah. If you had, you know, this much time after work and a designated driver, and right. You know, and then like
and it ultimately drinking. Becomes like you plug a restaurant, like that you're not even, you don't even have to know the chef, but like if you do or if you're just particularly excited, it seems like it becomes sort of like an industry plug situation.
Sure, you kind of, it's like a relay race of culinary to your friends.
Yeah. Like you and I think that's why the show, one of the contributing reasons why it was so successful, like you're saying, you know, you fielded this thing to some friends. It was like a word of mouth situation. So you had this kind of crazy access to these, like, you know, these great chefs in New York. Like Jonathan Benno is like one of the most badass chefs in New York. And like,
super talented. but also very much, which I like, he is the chef. He's not in it for what, you know, a lot of other people who are, okay, I got one thing open. Now where's my show? What do you want me on? You know, it's like, this is not, you know, he just doesn't run Surf Lodge, you know, no offense to whoever runs that, but like you open up a million things that close and you just have your PR people fucking, just, you know,
dishing it out.
Yeah. Hey, can you put them on this? Can you put them on that?
I listened to your podcast on Vice and you guys spent some time talking about Jonathan Bennett. So I don't like, I hope I'm not rehashing something you feel like you have to talk about.
No, you know
what? It's so funny.
It brings light to something that is, I think, a truthful video. This person did not like this process. He even says it. I thought this was going to be, I make something and we, and we stop. And I do this and we stop.
Oh, right.
And he just ends up having, he brings us to Netta, which at the time kind of was Nick Kim and Jimmy Chow's, Jimmy Lau's place before they had Shuko. And they were coming from Masa and Bar Masa respectively. And they, you know, opened up this incredible spot. Most amazing sushi with peanut butter ice cream at the end. And, you know, he gets in the car afterwards and he says, can you turn the camera off? And I was like, no, this is the part that we're here for. And he's like, please turn the camera off. And then it just kind of starts devolving from there. That's, you know, and then the next day we showed up to do the follow-up interview. And I was like, listen, don't worry. You know, like, I know you had a bad time or, you know, it was uncomfortable. Just talk about it truthfully.
Yeah. You know? Did he?
I think he does. You know, go and look it up.
I've seen it, but I haven't seen it in a while.
So he just says it right away. He's like, you know, I thought it was going to be quick and it wasn't.
But don't you think that it started to fall off during dinner at Netta?
Yes.
Because it was him and two others.
Yep, it was his.
And nobody said a word. It was a meal in silence.
Which, though, he does explain in the follow-up interview that it was revelatory. Is that the proper word? You know, that it was like the first time he had eaten at French Laundry or something like that. He said it was incredible, and he was so glad
that he got taking it
in. Yeah.
And which I think, didn't make for good TV.
But, you know, in the follow-up interview, you can talk about that. You can say, hey, I had this piece of this. I felt like this when this was happening. I was thinking that's kind of how a lot of shows are made. You film an action, and then you talk about the specific actions that you're seeing.
When I was listening to you talk about it, I was like, wow, this is like, this guy is so intelligent and so like, has the admiration of so many other chefs. Like, I've always looked up to Jonathan Bennett. I've gotten to meet him a few times.
Yeah.
He never remembers.
I just sent someone to Benno recently. Hey, you should go check out this restaurant.
I got the impression that he just like never got it. Like he never like understood. But at the interview process, did it like did the circle complete? Did he understand? And he just didn't like it.
No, I think it's like, hey, whatever, that was over and that's done. And thank you very much. But
But what was the best part of it? Did you watch the whole thing?
Oh, at the end when he left before his friends.
But it was
the end meal. The end meal is supposed to be this big celebratory thing. And it was a silent meal of the best tripe cutlet sandwich you've ever seen.
I would love to
almost,
eat that sandwich.
Almost in the dark at the bar of the restaurant. Yeah. Just in silence. It was awesome.
Uh-huh. And that episode also connected me, though, with some great people, some people who kind of share the same sensibility, you know, and are like, oh, that was very funny. That was like that was like the anti-party episode. At the same time, we were doing a lot of the team in Canada was doing a lot of episodes, and some of them are great. The Bar Isabel episode and Black Hoof, a bunch. And but those guys really got into it and celebrated the format and would go crazy, and they were turning lobster tails into vodka like luges and they went off. And so it was very fun to see like what's the polar opposite of that, you know?
Right.
Who were the most interesting? So that was a really interesting one.
Yeah.
And I don't want to say who were your favorites, but like
Brad Spence down in Philadelphia when he was at Amis. That was probably the most eye-opening thing.
In what way?
That was the first time I really went down to Philadelphia to eat.
Oh, really?
And he brought us to Paisano's Philly Style, which is a big sandwich shop was in the Italian Market. Now it's just over in Fishtown, I believe. Brought us to Han Dynasty, which is now
everywhere,
all over the place. And Han, he talked about how his fantasy was to get a blowjob while playing video games. And Brad doesn't drink.
Which is totally feasible.
Yes.
Like, the fact that that's like his one day.
And then also Brad was such a good guy, and Amis and the Vetri group. But it's funny because we try to get Mark Vetri on, and then their PR person this guy Kong, who's
is that
incredible.
The one who said is the best thing I've had since seeing Granny Porn last week?
Yes, that was that episode, and that was that Peter McAndrews, the guy from Paisanos, and yeah, that was just that was amazing, and it just kind of we try to get Mark Vetri because I really like this this. He had a bucatini with roasted cauliflower and Brussels sprout recipe and in Food and Wine. And it was kind of like, you know, it's seasoned with anchovies. And I was like, oh, this is great. And I'd read about Vetri in Food and Wine magazines at my mom, you know, at my parents' house in the 90s. And I was like, oh, I'd like to do this. And he was like, you know what? I'm going to hit my two partners off. It was Jeff Michaud and Brad Spence. So both of those guys. There's also a restaurant that Jeff had called Alla Spina under the Vetri Group. That was like this Italian Italian brew pub. Cool. Or what, yeah, whatever you call it. And they had incredible food. And
I didn't know Brad was a partner.
Yeah, those were...
I just thought, yeah.
Yeah.
Vetri recently... Like not sold out in a bad way, but I mean he
sold to Urban Outfitters.
They sold to Urban Outfitters and Urban Outfitters because they wanted to put restaurants with all of their, you know, they kind of wanted to do like this package deal where you get like the home goods,
right?
Store, you'd get one of their.
It's like IKEA.
Yeah, kind of.
Right. People, and then people go to IKEA to eat. No, but people go to IKEA.
No, but
to
they wanted to do Vetri pizza. They had some of their casual concepts that they wanted to recreate. And I think, you know, never all those guys are doing their own thing now.
I hear the Urban Outfitters Instagram. If you, I don't even know where I heard this, but if they to post a picture from Urban Outfitters Instagram account, it goes through 500 people.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you got to be careful with social media. A lot of people, a lot of tone deaf people, and
yeah.
That's
one right here. So, Brad Spence, who's the next two?
Brad Spence. I would say.
Who's a fun one?
Fun one that I was on. Oh, State Bird Provisions.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys. Stuart. That was.
I finally got to eat there a couple years ago.
It's amazing.
So good.
The restaurant was incredible. The places they took us were fun. The people that were there were fun.
Yeah.
Somebody jumped in the car that I went to high school with that they were going with. I was like, Liz, what are you doing here? She's kind of. She was the art director at Bon Appetit and then went to Afar and all that stuff. And so it wasn't like totally random, but totally random that I would see them. And then the party afterwards, they made this goat curry and roti. And, you know, the schedule was also the next day was not. Get up and shoot another one right away. So afterwards we got to hang out with the staff and, you know, put our head under the beer tap and whatnot. But, those guys are incredible.
Yeah.
And, that was a lot of fun and they were enthusiastic and generous and they just knew how to go with it, you know?
Yeah. Not surprising after eating at their restaurant.
No.
They know how to throw a party in their dining room.
Yeah.
Every night. Cool. Well, that was a lot of good questions after the game of
it's a good segue.
Play. Well, you know, we haven't even hit the interview session, and had some good stuff.
Sure.
So, basically, should be explaining why Patrick and Emily aren't here. They're at the Good Food Awards. Which
What's
is
that?
Yeah,
what is that?
So it's a big. You know, an award situation where you get acknowledged for, you know, it's like
food.
Chocolatiers and, you know, spirits, craftsmen, you know, it's basically, I think collaboratively all these craft, you know, food makers and, you know, different types of craftsmen. I think they make up like $2 billion worth of gross domestic product. So basically this annual awards ceremony.
So are they nominated?
All made in America.
Yeah, all made in America. And you know, Patrick and Emily at Heritage work with a lot of these guys, and I think a lot of them won some good food awards. So shout out to, like, you know, Paradise Locker and among others. I think Tempesta makes a really good mortadella. Chris, I know you'd be into that.
Oh, that'd be
so
great.
So is Patrick he nominated?
No. He's just going
attended.
Out there supporting.
Got it.
Yep.
I worked with this French woman at Balthazar. She was a server. And she would always talk about what she would bring home to her family. And the main things were either, you know, American whiskey or bourbon and what's it called? Maple syrup.
Oh, yeah.
She's like, these are very American products. We have nothing with the flavor profile of these things in Europe. So, and I was like, that kind of like turned my head around on things that, you know, uniquely American products like that, that you can, that you would want to gift somebody. And
that's interesting. I mean, growing up in Richmond, Virginia, we never, you know, maple syrup was just not something that we were super excited about. But, you know, annually we would, you know, it was always good, but it was a tableside situation.
What were you excited about?
But we went annually, just going to ignore you, Mac, to...
It's a fair question. What in Richmond, Virginia,
a lot of things.
Because I can tell you in Cincinnati, peanuts. Ohio, we're excited about.
No, peanuts are a big thing. Yeah. Like my grandfather is from Georgia, would always want boiled peanuts no matter where we went. Yeah. But in Virginia, it's always like roasted, you know, like salted peanuts are the best. I actually genuinely always excited to talk about peanuts. But the maple syrup, we go to this maple syrup festival up in the mountains where my uncle lives, Bath County in Highland County, Virginia. And I mean, it is like a crazy thing that you just don't even, that you don't know exists. And there are these fairs in these, you know, little county towns and, you know, tons of maple syrup available, but also there are people making like pork rinds the size of your chest, like, you know, to all sorts. It's awesome. But it's definitely like you know, it's interesting to hear somebody, a European person,
She lived in America for many years, but she's like, this is what I bring them. And I think of things like that, you know, you could celebrate as like, oh, hey, here's this. If someone, you've got a friend coming over from somewhere for them to try.
So what is unique to New Jersey? Like boiled peanuts to Richmond, Virginia?
Blueberries. Blueberry. The blueberry was domesticated in New Jersey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's so that blueberries, tomatoes. I think some of the best tomatoes when tomato season come around are coming from Jersey.
Jersey tomatoes are ridiculous, which is also, you know, Virginia and Richmond, we pride ourselves on Hanover tomatoes. But I have to say, a Jersey tomato in the first 2 weeks of August. Mac,
what about
dying.
A dish?
I am.
Popular
thing right now that a lot of people might know is, you know, the vinegar chicken, right? It's on the menu at Bernie's and whatnot.
Delicious.
Inspiration from that is from the Belmont Tavern. Shout out to Darren Palace for kind of shedding some light on that place. I think a lot of, you know, this kind of Italian-American food renaissance that New York dining scene is having. It's funny because it's very familiar to me, but I think it's exciting for people that move here from other parts of the country because now it's something new for them. When like American comfort food was the trend in New York restaurants, that's actually the first time I ever had a French dip or deviled eggs or anything. We didn't have that stuff in my house.
Yeah.
So like when somebody was like, oh, this is, I can't believe they're selling this. This is what we have in, you know, Wisconsin. I was like, oh, I never had this before.
You were shocked.
I was like, hey, this is great. Wow. Deviled eggs. Good.
Yeah,
you know,
pimento cheese. Wow.
It's funny to think that.
Yeah. Yeah. I never had those things. So when I see now people like, wow, have you had, you know, this kind of like Italian American food, bar pies and, you know, all this stuff. I'm like, that's kind of the stuff I grew up with. And I like seeing people's interpretations of that. And
do you like the one at Bernie's, the vinegar chicken?
Yeah, Bernie's.
So
incredible.
Speaking of
Bernie's, is a beautiful, perfectly executed restaurant. And I always think that when you heard about the Frankel's guys and them, like music industry people, there's a bunch of partners, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, just go there and judge it on the service and the food, and it's fantastic. You get your food. It's not, they're there to be in business. We talk about this, that I like places that are there to make money.
Yeah.
I don't want to go and, oh, it's great that this guy is, I don't care about a home cook in a fucking storefront. Show me someone that can move.
Yeah.
It's going to make money so they can be there.
It's a pro.
Yeah. I like that. You know, that's kind of the whole, you want excitement.
Yeah.
Right?
They're hungry to satisfy people, take care of people.
Yeah.
So let's talk about vinegar chicken really quick. We had dinner the other night, right? And
you and I?
Yep.
Okay.
And we were talking about Morris Murdoch. My father does one of his famous dishes where he does the whole chicken leg on the grill. He says it's away from the fire. It's called indirect heat. And he simply does what is arguably the most amazing seasoning for poultry.
Celery salt.
Celery salt. Yeah. Right? I mean, it's not like groundbreaking, but you know, it is.
No, it's like one
and
of
then
those...
he and then he has a spray bottle with white vinegar. So every 20 minutes go out and spray.
Celery salt makes chicken taste more like chicken.
It's delicious. Yeah.
It does, you know. That's also the best secret ingredient in a Bloody Mary.
Yeah, agreed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny, there's like a few kind of American I don't even want to say it's an American ingredient, but like if, you know, I don't know, when I was cooking when I was 15, 16 years old, like every recipe had a little bit of celery salt, yeah. a little bit of Tabasco, uh-huh. and like, you know, the
way to turn things up.
Yeah. Right? It's these low key kind of, you know, very, you know, small amounts that just really,
you guys are chefs. What does celery salt add? Is that, I mean, obviously it's the salt, I guess I answered that part, but what else is in that that
I
gives
think celery
it that-
has this like. This actually, it's like this light, spicy vegetal thing that just like it's not quite an allium, but you know, it's like garlic salt's really good, but it tastes like garlic. Like, celery salt has this kind of like, you know, just this savory kind of quality that you don't really.
Sometimes you can't identify it. Yeah. And if you ask somebody who doesn't know, they wouldn't know like
chicken
that
bouillon?
You put celery salt on it. They right? would just know that it tastes delicious.
I mean, chicken stock as one, like, you know, the mirepoix on it. And like, you know, celery is a part of mirepoix. It's like a fundamental building block of flavor in, you know, French and American, you know, food culture. So it's not crazy that.
Okay. You can also use chicken stock base as a seasoning.
Yeah.
We can talk about that later.
So this was all redirected by me to get back to me.
Yeah. You've just been dying.
Yeah. Which there's outside
Skyline
of,
Chili.
Outside of Skyline Chili and outside of Grater's Ice Cream and Montgomery and Barbecue Sauce, or just Montgomery and Barbecue in general. Cincinnati is a German city.
Okay.
So most people have never heard of this, but Geta. You ever heard of Geta?
Go on.
Spell it, please.
Get out of here.
Geta, Goetta.
Yes.
Do you know what Geta is?
No, but I've heard it.
Okay, so it is sometimes, I have my phone here, but it's sometimes described as fried mush, which is obviously not flattering. But what it really is pork sausage combined with oats and then fried on a griddle.
Oh, so it's like scrapple.
Or blood sausage.
Right.
Without blood.
More sausagey.
Right.
Right.
But there's no blood.
Yeah, but the oats go into, that's what the blood binds to, right?
Right. Oats are like, if you're in North, rice.
Yeah. Yes.
It
has a texture and color and it's like, usually looks like a burger patty almost, but it's a square.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's Geta. And most people like don't get it.
And that's a Cincinnati.
It's very much a Cincinnati thing, which is obviously stolen from, it's German.
Do you fry it or do you like griddle that and put it on a sandwich?
It's very much like a breakfast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you have like Geta.
Oh, okay.
You just style. Like whatever and Geta.
Yeah, that's cool. It's I mean, yeah, maybe not in flavor profile. It doesn't sound like it tastes like scrapple, but just like the concept of, you know, putting oats or grains with a farce and, you know, stretching it and then making this delicious, you know, sausage type thing. That's
so the follow up to this says it bears a resemblance to scrapple. So it's interesting you said that, which is popular in Pennsylvania. Scrapple is made with corn flour and spices rather than oats.
Oh, right. Okay,
so that's
cool.
the difference. Same concept.
Yeah. Wow.
Obviously ours is like probably better.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway. All right. Well, listen, let's take a quick second to thank our sponsors and hit a little break.
Is this the break?
Yeah, let's do the break and we'll come back and we'll dive right into the interview stuff.
Perfect.
All right.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese, a passion for great taste. Forever Cheese sources a curated collection of unique cheeses and specialty foods from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia. They have pioneered numerous important products that are now integral to today's market, including many under their brand Matika. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Oh.
All right, you guys are listening to The Main Course, broadcasting live on Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. We got Chris Grosso and Mac Murdoch in the studio. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
So this is the weekly grill, the interview section, which we've been kind of jumping into already. But Chris, I think you've really revolutionized the way people interview chefs and kind of engage restaurants and food scenes, just because, you know, like we touched on this earlier, like, you know, it's kind of, you kind of created this network of people you were interviewing and putting on Munchies by word of mouth. You know, people who are like interested, even Jonathan Minow, the episode wasn't, you know, basically the model episode, but you still got like a really clear window into what Jonathan is like as a chef. You know, he's all business, and that's super respectable. Even if it didn't work for like a show alluding to, you know, not necessarily getting stoned, but perhaps getting stoned and eating late and drinking. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't go to school for cooking, ended up being a chef. And while I certainly identify disadvantages from that approach, I think there's also a lot of advantages. And, you know, I know a little bit about your history and your, you know, how you started doing TV production and being a director. So can you tell us a little bit about your approach to production and, you know, specifically regarding food and beverage and how your past experiences set you up for success?
Oh, perfect. All right. So let's try to get the baseline info done in 1 minute. Yeah. Growing up, my mother was a teacher. My father actually worked at Random House, was a sales manager, but, you know, in books. We had a big library. My dad is also a great cook. But then he left that and went into the deli business. He had a cousin that was in the deli business in New Jersey, a great place called Grosso's in Franklin Lakes that a lot of people, you know, might have been to. And then my dad got the opportunity to buy a deli in Wyckoff, New Jersey, from a German guy named Cornelius Yoke, which is, that's worth mentioning. And he bought this deli and. You know, and that kind of, so by the time I'm 12, I start working there, you know, stocking the soda case, et cetera. And just kind of always, you know, food was always a big thing. People talk about, oh, I've set my grandmother's apron tugging on it to have her show me. I didn't do any of that. Yeah, I actually was a very picky eater. I didn't eat meat till I was 21. I didn't eat anything besides pasta and butter and other things until I was about 12, 10 maybe. Mm-hmm. The first time I ever had tomato sauce was because a kid named Tim Kies in fourth grade. We had like a little, everyone had to bring in a food from their home. And here's this German kid who liked tomato sauce and bread. And because I didn't want to seem like a little bitch, I was dunking the, I was like, oh, this is good. I didn't start eating.
Did you actually like it?
Yes. I just didn't, I mean, everything like that was always, I think, to, you know, prove myself in front of other people. I used to scream when I would go on rides until I went to Great Adventure with my good friend. And he was like, do you want to go on this? It was like the worst, the scariest roller coaster in the East Coast. I was like, yeah, of course. And so I went from like being scared of like the teacups to going on the Ultra Twister, look that up. Yeah. So it's whatever, like work in the deli, start really liking
the
food.
Deli though. That was it.
That's the base. Go to school for a little while for history. Think I want to work in documentary. I have no idea.
Like video documentary? That's kind of like
I wanted to work on the History Channel or A&E Biography.
That makes a lot of
sense. How people did that, I have no clue. I never thought about the process. Nothing. Yeah. I was like, I like this. I would just go. I still have my A&E Biography VHSs. Yeah. Watch. Oh, I'm going to work there. You know, there's a History Channel billboard.
That is awesome.
That's on the Queens side. If you're driving down the FDR, you always see that. I was like, oh.
That's me.
I was like, oh, that's where I want to work. Yeah. No idea. Start going to school in Manhattan just so I could live next to my favorite skateboard spot. So I went to Pace University right across from the Brooklyn Banks. And, you know, was into food and always kind of liked it. Went to school in Italy for 6 months. That was eye-opening. You know, we would visit my family in Italy growing up. But, you know, food-wise, besides pastina and brodo or tortellini and brodo, I didn't really eat anything. And then I came back from Italy and worked at my dad's deli for like 8 months straight and moved. And then finally moved out of the house completely, dropped out of school, sort of. And then I heard you could make $250 a night cash working at Ruby Foos.
Boom. Ruby Foos.
Here we go.
First time I ever had edamame.
Oh, yes, I waited on him.
He gave it to me. I ate it whole.
You waited on Mac?
I think it was your first night in New York City.
I was up visiting my friend Emily, is how I met Chris, because they worked at Ruby Foos together, and the idea was that I was going to check out her apartment to see if I wanted to move here. Chris was our server, and I never had sushi, never had edamame, and I was hammered, and ate a whole bowl of edamame whole.
But I watched him eat the whole bowl, and I was like, hey, you shouldn't do
Everybody
that.
Watched me.
Yeah, yeah, it was very funny.
I was like that guy.
Wait, is this the spot where you would ring in sushi, like, to false tables, perhaps?
I would like, if it was so busy and crazy that the sushi chef there one time rubbed wasabi in my eyes. He was so mad.
But did he like aggressively do it, or did he trick you, like kind of like he's giving you
a hug? He was hyper aggressive, but we were good friends.
Yeah.
And I would watch him, you know, his first language was Chinese, and I would watch him fight with the coffee guy whose first language was Bengali.
Dude, the Bengali.
And they used to just yell at each other, suck dick, fuck dick, and then fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And but like, it was like fun, you know, it was hyper aggressive and fun.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
everyone got in on it.
Big restaurants are so fun. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, it was my first time not working for my dad.
Yeah,
I would
juggle
plates, pre-service meeting. You know, I was like, oh, it was like school again. You know?
But it was all actors you were working with, right?
Oh, I mean, funny people,
right? So like extroverts and like all these people. Yeah. And there was Chris, who was like not the actor, but probably the biggest, you know.
Oh, I met so
personality
many
of all
there.
Of them.
Yeah. Fast forward, I stay working in restaurants. Mm-hmm. I worked at Ruby Foos, the Tribeca Grill for a little while, then went to Balthazar. And then there is, I would just meet a lot of the customers were always very nice to you. And they were from everywhere. And they were, you know, here's this artist. And here's Jonathan Miller. He started the Beyond the Fringe Festival with fucking Dudley Moore. And he's also a neuroscience person. And he recently passed away in November. But he was the person I just sit there and listen to. I'm like, man, all these fucking people do everything that they want to do, right? They just do it. And they're smart. And I remember one night I was at a party at this very famous artist's like studio that he lived above, and there were just all these people there that did exactly what they wanted, except me. I mean, I loved working in restaurants,
yeah,
and I loved it, but I was like, this is
why am I not like doing A&E internship on the side?
Exactly, or like, right? And then Vice launched their online TV network called VBS.TV. It was about they had a lot of different shows on it, but this one skateboard documentary show called Epically Latered was on there.
Great show.
Watched four episodes, wrote a MySpace message to the host, and was like, hey, I'm not trying to be on your blog. You had a very popular blog at the time. Right. I actually would just like to help you out. I've got these skate videos. I've got my whole skate video library, because I noticed some of the archival was off, and not because they didn't know, but just because they didn't have the stuff at arm's length. So, long story short, I started working at Vice doing the skateboard thing. Then they started doing the Munchie show. Now, I was not a part of that. It was Chris Chikin and this guy, Toby, who's a salesperson. And I was like, oh, I can help you with that. I can help you with that.
Yeah.
A couple years go by. I start getting my feet more in it. I'm full time. I left, you know, restaurants full time. And then finally, it was an opportunity. I was like, we're just going to take this show.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I was like, hey, we got to revamp this. And then myself with Lauren Cinnamon, who is kind of, who was the editor and producer of Epically Latered as well. We had been working together for a while and brainstorming things that we wanted to do. So we just put it together like that and kind of applied. You know, I didn't have to think about anything skateboard history wise.
Right.
I could just focus on learning how to make a video.
Yeah.
Or you know, because it was like, and that's kind of what the food thing was too. I can focus on, you know, listening to these amazing editors and filmmakers and, you know, and Lauren in particular. But I was like, here's the information we've got to focus on.
Right.
You know, and I think that's what's missing in a lot of documentary stuff.
Yeah, you were like, able to identify, like, you know, because you know the restaurant business.
Yeah, and I'm someone in the middle. I respect the filmmaking process and I respect the restaurant process.
Right.
So now I'm kind of like fighting with myself. What do we want to do? You know, where do we want to? Do we want to lean more towards respect to the filmmaking process or more respect to the restaurant process?
Right.
And I think that's kind of, you know, we're not looking for free meals. I think a lot of food press is people looking for free meals or how can they be down? And, you know, and in fact, like after we film with someone, I didn't like really going back to the, to the restaurant because I feel like I've got my fucking hat in hand. Like,
give me
three free appetizers. You know, like, show my friend how you know me. You know? I don't like that shit.
You know, like, you look at Chef's Table, right? The Netflix show, right? Like, that, I mean, all of these, you know, interview kind of get to know the chef. Like, you guys are really kind of like some of the first people to, like, if not just the first people to really like take the veil off a little bit and, like, you know, change the way people understood, like, industry, like, what it was really like to be in the restaurant.
The service industry is its own demographic, right? Yeah. Like, that's how, and then me and Mac, that's how we reconnected after many years. He talked to our mutual friend again, and he entered cooking, and you should talk about that. Like,
no, but I ran into Chris. I remember we were in Soho, and I saw Chris on the street, and it had been years. But I had heard from Emily Crosby Morgan that Chris had been doing
City Skinny.
Yep. Renamed it, though. That he was doing Munchies at the time. And we were all watching it. It was season one. And I was like, I think it was only like three episodes in. And then he was like, I would love to do craft because that's where I was working at the time. And then I just segued the conversation because James Tracy was the chef. But yeah, I mean, it was crazy. Like,
James is a great example of an episode of someone that doesn't get what was going on, but also that doesn't care what's going on.
No, either. I was just thinking, we were talking about Benno. It's like, James was so, like,
he's so casual,
but, like, you know, he's like sly, you know, really smooth, like shooting, you know, sinking on the pool table, throwing back shots, made a really good dish. It was like a very fun party episode.
That was a fun.
It was just fun. A really fun time. Like, we were just like cooks and excited to be like hanging out with, you know, the sous chefs and the chefs.
That was the best part about doing my, and that's like when you go and film somewhere and maybe the chef didn't know exactly what was going on or wouldn't tell you that.
Yeah.
But like talking with like the other people in the kitchen, and like it gave, I think, chefs and people in restaurant industry something to watch after their shift. Because that's how I even learned about VBS is after my dinner shifts at Balthazar, I'd go home and I'd, you know, decompress by watching the skateboard stuff. And so now they could go and it could validate them in a non, you know, dickheadish way, like, oh, I'm saving the world and look how I suffer behind the line. It's like, oh, hey, you know what, this is camaraderie, this is fun.
Exactly.
That's why we
and it's
we
not just it. The cooks, it's also the front of the house.
The front of the house gets
that's actually how
I think it highlights like what you hang out with everybody. It's like high school.
That episode is kind of how we met too, remember? Because I came back the next day from the party to grab
James made you, because we got kegs, and I was setting up for a private event because it was in the private dining room, and Trigg walks in. He was this little, well, he's a big guy, but a young man at the time with a big giant book in his pocket, and it was your day off, and I was like, why would you come here and do this? And you just said, because James asked you.
Did you make the Egg McMuffin? Were you on Man in the Grill?
Yeah, I was. Mitchell and I were right cooking the sandwiches.
It was delicious. Remember it caught on fire?
Yeah, I thought we were going to get fired. I was like, we fucked up.
Chaz got kicked out. Remember that?
Fully blacked out.
Yeah.
Guy with the clear glasses. Yes. The glass frames. Yeah. I always remember that.
Charles Lindsay.
86.
He did get 86.
That's why I like the restaurant industry approach to, it's almost like the Japanese businessman model of go out, you get fucked up, you know, you get sent home, but it's like you come back the next day and you're like, as long as you didn't hurt anybody, you're like, okay, you're back.
You work hungover, and when you're, you know, doing something physical, you know, it's easy to like put, you know, drama aside. Because I washed dishes in my restaurant 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Our guy didn't show up. I didn't want to hire somebody for one night.
Yeah.
I washing dishes is like, you know, if you're in a busy restaurant and you're disadvantaged in terms of equipment or space, you know, like, I didn't have my cell phone on me for like 6 hours straight. It was so therapeutic.
Yes.
And like, it was amazing.
Systematic.
But whether you're
getting caught up though on the edge of the sheet pan under the lip and like, I'm going to get all of the crust off of that.
If you watch a really good dishwasher, they have the most amazing tricks you've ever seen.
Oh my God.
They make at Kraft, they've had the same dishwashers forever, right?
Yeah.
Shout out to Leo, Hector, who else? On Hill at a time. Anyways, they would make these mixtures that you wouldn't know what they were. It was like chemicals that they found
egg
somewhere.
Whites and vinegar and lemon juice.
And this stuff could get anything off. Yeah. And everything came back looking brand new in like 2 seconds.
Yeah, it was like the coppers are like mirrors.
Bicarbonate of soda. When I watch like a period piece of like dining and you see that, all I think about is like, how'd they get those pots clean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, how much scrubbing did that take?
A lot.
You know, without a lot of running water?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? What did you do?
Yeah.
That
I mean,
sucked.
But I think the, you know, being able to
just focus on the task at hand. Like I heard you talk about like working hungover. The best thing you do when you're hungover is go to work, right? Like,
oh yeah. If I'm clean at work, this is more of the years ago now, but if I, my hair was perfectly combed and, you know, like neck shaved halfway up and
yeah,
a new shirt, that meant I was hungover. If I was actually sitting at my computer the whole day, yeah, cause I was just like,
oh, hey Chris, good to see you.
Oh yeah. Hanging on, hanging in there. And like, but also if you're the right amount of hungover, you in an office setting,
yeah,
you've got, you know, you start coming around and you're below the age of 30 or early 30s, you start coming around at 5 and then you can fucking, it's like putting turbo boosters on the rest of the team because you've been doing your work all day, and then when they're falling off you're like,
just starting to feel better.
You're the one sending the annoying end of the day emails like, hey, how about this, how about this?
Yeah, and then you're all pumped on.
It's true.
So look, we're almost getting down to the end here, and Mac, we got a couple speed questions we wanted to surprise you with, Chris. We didn't include these in our overview email.
Who's it? You and Mac are going to ask these to me? Or
yeah,
you
yeah,
guys
yeah, 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 yeah.
Okay, these great.
Just, all right, so this is, you can't think about it. You just have to answer, okay, right? Hence speed questions.
Great.
But you can elaborate a touch.
Yeah, well, you got
to
cut
the initial off. Answer has to go now.
Yeah, okay. I'll keep going.
Ready? What restaurant that is now closed in the greater New York area you wish is still open?
And it's in its form when it's frozen in time, or yeah, it's just what yeah, the evolution was? I would like to go back and taste Union Pacific, Rocco Despirito's restaurant that closed in 2003.
Okay. Best late night food in all of New York City?
Best late night food in all of New York City would have to be fried rice.
Wohop?
No. Great New York Noodle Town or anything, any type of...
You went a different route. You gave the food.
Yeah.
Restaurant.
Restaurant.
Because it can be the hang, too.
It could be the hang.
Could be the drinks. Could be the food.
Past or present?
Whatever.
Past Enoteca.
Okay. For some reason, Trigg wrote something in here about, is your dream Munchies episode still to do something at Teterboro with Mario Batali and a Cessna? I don't know what that means. Most underrated food neighborhood in New York City?
Oh, I don't know if they're... It's underrated, but right now my current obsession is Astoria.
You do love Astoria.
Yeah.
Best pizza?
Currently, got to give it to Lindstry.
Best sandwich shop?
Best sandwich shop in New York City?
Mm-hmm.
DeFonte's.
Best sandwich there?
Best sandwich at DeFonte's? Anything with the fried eggplant used as the accent, not as the main.
Yes.
Main ingredient, because it's almost like putting tempura flakes in a roll. But fair. The last thing I had there was the roast pork with broccoli rabe, the crispy eggplant, sharp provolone, and hot peppers.
Mm. Okay. Your last meal before you die?
Eggplant hero.
Where?
Back in time again to Italian Food Center, which was on the corner of... Grand in, oh, you know what? Fuck living in the past. I would say it's going to have to be maybe
Angelo's?
Angelo's South Philly Fuck. Pizzeria, the Philly food dude, or the Sunday morning. I would say dealer's choice. Just give me that again, the bread. The it's bread so makes good. The sandwich. Yeah, and then totally. When the stuffing, and then when the, what's in it is, it kills it. And I think that's.
I like that you say dealer's choice too.
Yeah. That's the
it's
biggest.
So hard to make a decision.
Yeah. The best, that's the thing that most New York sandwich places have going against it is the bread. It's just not that good. That's what the Italian Food Center, I don't know where they were getting their semolina heroes from, but incredible.
So we went and got sandwiches, what, 2 weeks ago or a week ago mm-hmm. in Astoria.
Yeah.
The first place we went to was...
Thanks for the invite, guys.
Rosario's.
Fuck myself.
We didn't invite you.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but Rosario's had the defining...
Incredible
factor, because we went to three places that day, was the bread.
Yeah, incredible.
You could have put anything on it.
It was. And
I think it was really simple. Or no, wait, that was a big one.
No, I mean, it was eggplant cutlet, broccoli rabe, sun-dried tomatoes, hot peppers, fresh mozzarella.
The second one was relatively simple.
That was at Sal, Chris, and Charlie's, and that was basically their Italian combo. And I'm not usually like a cold-cut hero person. You know, I like chicken cutlets or eggplant cutlet or...
Roast pork meatball.
And what was the third one?
Third one was
second best deli in New York City,
Cerezo's, and that had good bread, and they had sun dried peppers, which is usually I only get those at Casa della Mozzarella.
Key
you know, that's yeah, you know, that's the Italian cooking. I think, you know, it's not revolutionary, but it's like, you know, that agro dolce. That's, you know, get me sweet and sour. It's anything.
Agrodolce is like the is like so crucial in any cuisine.
Here, we'll throw one more speed question on. Most or favorite underused ingredient on a sandwich?
I mean, my favorite, eggplant.
I like how you talk about like the flakes, like likening them to tempura flakes.
Definitely.
So crucial. It just soaks up all that juice so it doesn't run out of the sandwich, right? Like,
yeah, and it gives it a different texture. And you see that in like in Sicilian stuff, in Sicilian sandwiches, you know, where they'll put the crispy chickpea flour. It's like soft ricotta, maybe an oven roasted tomato, you know, and then that to give it that crunch. And I have a friend who pointed this out, like, you know, going into like a true, forgive me if I'm wrong, like South Indian restaurant to look at some of the people under the table at the purses, whether it's some potato chips that they're eating along with it to give it that different texture.
That's a thing.
Yeah, if you go into like an Udupi Palace on Valencia and 19th or something in San Francisco, this vegetarian Indian place, that was the first place I ate in after this person sent me to like point that out, and I was just like, oh, that's perfect. That's kind of why you put your potato chips on your sandwich. This is not like lowbrow or revolutionary.
No, I love potato chips on a sandwich.
Exactly.
What else are they eating? I mean, is there something?
Is anything else? It's just a counterpoint in texture, and I think that's where, you know, you need that.
Yeah, it's like a flavor sponge in the middle of your sandwich, but it's not doesn't have sponge consistency.
But it's also, if I'm going to have something soft, give me that crunch, and then that's where you're creating the tension of the meal.
Totally agree. It always comes back to sandwiches. We didn't get to this question, but you know,
we used to put French fries on our sandwiches. Oh, I invented that.
No, and
Marymount High School, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah.
What's it called?
1994 to 1998.
The meatloaf at what was that place called? With crispy onions. I'm sorry.
It wasn't.
No, it closed down, and I ate there 10 million times. And the Cal was the chef at Dumont Burger. Man. And then he had, I'm drawing a blank, South Hershey, but he had you know, crispy onions on his meatloaf. So soft meatloaf, caramelized bits, and then that was what, you know,
all right, good. We got to wrap it up, guys. Okay. Thank you for coming, Mac and Chris. It's been a good episode. And
good
check times. Us out next week.
Thank you very much.
The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.